In a joint statement, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and the American Society for Reproductive Medicine say many chemicals that pregnant women absorb or ingest from the environment can cross the placenta to the fetus. Reducing exposure to toxic environmental agents is a critical area of intervention for obstetricians, gynecologists, and other reproductive healthcare professionals. So what do these toxins do to the fetus? How can you keep your baby safe? Stay with us. Go Healthy for Good starts right now. I'm Dr. Nerida. Welcome to Go Healthy for Good. In the last 15 years, scientific evidence has shown that exposure to toxic environmental agents before conception and during pregnancy can have significant and long-lasting effects on reproductive health across the course of life. Those are the words of the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. So how serious is the situation? Here's the answer from nutritionfacts.org.
Every few years, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention measures the level of chemical pollutants in the bodies of thousands of Americans from across the country. What did the latest report tell us about our toxic burden? Or more importantly, that of pregnant women in the United States? Published last summer in the Journal of the U.S. National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, here is the list of chemicals they measured on the left, and on the right is the percentage of women, both pregnant and non-pregnant, with detectable levels of these pollutants in their bodies. Look at those numbers. Most women in this country are contaminated with heavy metals, a number of toxic solvents, endocrine disruptors, fire retardant chemicals, PCBs, and pesticides like DDT. And that's just the first page. Continuing on the next page, more pesticides, plastics, chemicals, industrial toxins circulating through their bloodstreams. Look at these numbers. In many cases, 99 or 100% of the hundreds of women tested were found with these chemicals in their bodies, and potentially passing them on to the next generation. On average, pregnant women harbored about 35 different chemicals. Each of these bars represents one woman. That's how many chemicals they found in their bodies. Bottom line, they found widespread exposure to pregnant women in the United States to multiple chemical compounds in their metabolites, including both banned and contemporary contaminants. Americans are walking chemical cocktails. So let us explore what consequences they may have and how to minimize our exposure to them.
To help tease out what might be in our chemical cocktails, I'll be joined shortly by Dr. Cynthia Barra. She's been researching toxins and their effects on babies for many years. But first, the news. In the headlines today, prenatal cocaine, smaller brain, acid suppressants in moms, increased asthma in kids, and baby foods fail to meet the grade. Women using cocaine during pregnancy have teens with lower gray matter volume in the brain and twice the chance of substance abuse. Previous studies show that preconceptual cocaine exposure, or PCE for short, impairs attention, impulse control, emotion regulation, and memory. This new study was done on two groups of adolescents, one with PCE and a matching group without. Researchers found that each 1 mL decrease in gray matter volume in the exposed group was associated with a 70 to 80% increased risk of substance abuse. Though the risk varied depending on which part of the brain was most affected, the most relevant areas were the frontal cortex and the parietal lobe. So please protect your baby's brain. Their success in life depends on you. The use of acid suppressive drugs by pregnant women is associated with an increased risk of asthma in their children. This Dutch study used siblings from the same mother as control subjects and found that the children with in utero exposure had a 2.5-fold increase in the risk of having asthma. Toddlers with asthma prescriptions were 85% more likely than their siblings to have been exposed to acid suppressive drugs prenatally. The mechanism is not entirely clear, though researchers speculate that acid suppressive drugs can interfere with the denaturation of food antigens, resulting in allergic sensitization and possibly asthma. So ladies, see if you can get off your acid suppressors before embarking on a pregnancy. Commercial baby food sold in the United Kingdom for weaning infants provides little extra nutritional benefit over breast milk, so say researchers from the University of Glasgow in Scotland. Additionally, almost half of the products were targeted at infants as young as 4 months, a time when babies should still be exclusively breastfed. The American Academy of Pediatrics advises that infants begin consuming foods in addition to milk after 4 months of age and preferably at 6 months of age. Researchers assessed over 400 types of commercial infant foods for texture, taste, and nutritional content. Protein content was 4 times higher than breast milk, while energy density was about half that of homemade baby foods. It seems that commercial baby food manufacturers may be more interested in their bottom line than the health of their consumers. I'm Dr. Nerida McKibben, and that's today's Health News. Joining me now in the studio is Dr. Barra, Chief of the Division of Neonatology at the University of Maryland Children's Hospital in Baltimore. We just heard that we all have chemicals coursing through our veins. So, Dr. Barra, on the basis of your research, is this true or is that just hype?
Oh, no, it's true. So, in a recent study, they looked at the cord blood of 10 babies, and more than 200 chemicals were identified in the umbilical cord blood. Now, so that's the blood that's in the baby.
And this baby hasn't walked the earth yet. It hasn't drunk water. It hasn't been exposed to the air and breathed any pollutants. It hasn't had any exposure, and yet how many chemicals?
Over 200. So the mother is exposed, and the chemicals get into her body and then can cross into the baby's body either through the placenta or through the amniotic fluid.
Now, we used to think that the mother protected the baby, right? That the placenta somehow kept these chemicals away from the baby.
Yes, that was the common understanding in the early part of the last century. And then thalidomide came along. And a pediatrician in England by the name of Dr. Smithels saw one of these babies with severe limb reduction defects where the baby lacked any arms or legs. And, you know, you will see a baby like that once in a while. But then in the same year, he saw a second one. And he and his counterpart in West Germany put together a study that identified thalidomide as the causative agent that was causing these birth defects.
So that popped the balloon on the belief that the placenta protected the baby, and we learned, in fact, that it doesn't always do that. Now, from your studies, how many measurable toxicants have you found in your studies for babies?
We did a study in Cincinnati called the Home Study and enrolled 450 mother-infant pairs into that study and examined the mother's blood during pregnancy, the cord blood at the time of delivery, and the meconium. And we didn't look for all the vast majority of the chemicals, but the ones we did, we found in the majority of the babies.
Now, the meconium, for people who don't know, is actually the stools from the baby, aren't they?
They're the first stools that a baby passes. They're very different than dirty baby diapers because this is the material that accumulates in the baby's GI tract during the pregnancy.
So this has been with the baby through its entire in utero life,
yes,
so to speak.
Yes.
Were there any surprises in the chemicals that you found?
Yes. We looked for a pesticide that had been phased out in the 70s because of its effect on bird eggshells. The name is DDT, and probably most people are still familiar with that. But when we looked in the meconium of these babies, all of them had a metabolite of DDT in their meconium.
Wow. So yes. Every single baby.
Every single baby.
Which tells us that these pesticides hang around for many, many years. Do they hang around in the environment? Do they actually hang around in our bodies?
I don't think anybody knows that. There was a class of chemicals called persistent organic pollutants. One of them is polychlorinated biphenyl. It was developed because it was a great transformer in electrical lines. You know, when you look up and you see those jug-like things on the crossbars, right?
Yes.
Those are the transducers, I think they're called. But they're filled of PCB, which was used because it was so unchangeable. It was just very
inert.
Stable and inert.
Yeah.
And so when those things cracked and spilled and it got into our environment, well, it still persists in our environment.
Wow. Well, we're going to hold that thought and come right back. After the break, we have a professional chef in the kitchen to demonstrate a breakfast favorite, so don't go away.
Oh man, I've got a headache. Do you have any aspirin?
How much water have you had today?
None, but I drink cola. Isn't that all right?
Cola doesn't count here. Have some proper drink.
Oh, how does that help?
Well, your brain is 85% water, so when you get dehydrated, it gets very dehydrated. It shrivels up and it starts to ache.
Well, I still need that aspirin because I got an aching back.
Really? Low back pain can be related to dehydration. You know your joints and your discs? They're made of water. So if you're dehydrated, they're going to be sore.
So I guess I'll drink to that then, huh?
Yeah. Why don't you? Then you'll feel much better.
Hmm. However, what about this fatigue? Are you going to tell me that that's due to dehydration as well?
Yes, you hit the nail on the head. You see, when your blood volume shrinks, your heart has to pump a lot faster. And the slightest exertion is going to make you feel exhausted.
Mm.
So you need to have more water.
Okay, well, is there anything you can do about this ringing in my ears?
Yeah. When your blood gets that thick and it's trying to squeeze through tiny capillaries, you need to dilute it with some water.
Some more water.
More water.
Okay, well, what about this cramping in my legs? What can I do for this leg cramps I'm having here?
Well, if the circulation to your muscles isn't very good, they're going to ache and cramp. So I think you need some more water.
Okay. Well, what about this terrible pain I'm suddenly having in my bladder? Does dehydration cause kidney stones?
It can do, but in your case, it probably would be cured by a quick trip to the bathroom.
Oh, I'd better go right away. Are you sure that water doesn't cure this as well?
Yeah, it cures many things, but a quick trip to the bathroom is what you need.
Oh, man, my bladder's about to splatter.
All right, I'll see you in a minute. Look for the many signs of dehydration. And remember, drink 6 to 8 glasses of water a day. Doctor's orders.
Welcome to Go Healthy's Kitchen, and today we have a great breakfast recipe. And with me to demonstrate that, right from his book Revive Cafe Cookbook, is Jeremy Dixon. Jeremy, welcome to Go Healthy. What recipe have you chosen for
this
breakfast?
This is Revive Muesli, or Revive Granola. And this is a great healthy way of having a breakfast cereal, mm-hmm. without all those ones in the supermarket that are just loaded with sugar and preservatives and flavours and colourings. This is a great healthy one to make yourself.
Excellent. Is it easy?
Extremely.
Okay, tell us what's in it.
Sure. 1 cup of jumbo rolled oats, 1 cup of quick oats, 1/2 cup of shredded unsweetened coconut, 3 tablespoons of sesame seeds, 3 tablespoons of sliced almonds, 3 tablespoons of cashew pieces, 3 tablespoons of sunflower seeds, 4 tablespoons of honey, 4 tablespoons of oil, 1/4 cup of raisins, and 1/2 cup of other dried fruit.
Boy, that sounds rich with lots of polyunsaturated fats and those nuts, protein, and then some whole grains.
The perfect way to start the day.
It is. That's going to sustain you right through the morning. You're not going to have a dump in sugar. So how do we do it?
Well, we just take the oats. Now, we're using whole oats and quick oats. Mm-hmm. Now, they're the exact same product, except one has been cut finer. And it just adds a bit of interest having the two different sizes. But if you only have one, either size will be fine.
Excellent.
We dump them in. And then we throw in some honey. And this will help bind it and make it nice and sweet. Better get all that out.
Honey's a lovely sweetener, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of my favourite ones.
Yeah. Agave can get really thick when you heat it, so.
Exactly. This is some oil. We have some coconut, and that just gives an amazing flavour and smell when it's toasted. Mm. Some people don't like coconut, so you can leave that out.
Now, the oil that I would usually use, I'd try and do a high smoke point oil, and what that means is you can bake it at a high temperature without it smoking and changing its molecular structure. Olive oil has a quite low smoke point. So what oil do you use?
Use either rice bran oil or grapeseed oil are 2 good oils to use.
Right.
That are good for this recipe.
So rice bran oil and grapeseed oil, they're actually a little bit more difficult to get in America because canola oil really has the market for the high smoke point. But if you're wanting to avoid canola, then the grapeseed oil and the rice bran oil are great alternatives. And I actually buy some online. Sometimes supermarkets will carry the grapeseed oil, but the rice bran oil is a little harder to find. But I find it has a lovely flavour for baking, so that's my favourite, my personal favourite. I wouldn't say it's necessarily better than the grapeseed oil, because we have a large grape industry across in California, we get grapeseed oil a little bit more easily now, and it's even coming through organic, which is lovely. That's looking wonderful.
Yep, this is our base mix. Now we're going to put it into an oven pan, mm-hmm. oven tray, and spread it out. And again, you may want to make double, triple, quadruple, even a 10 times recipe and bulk mm-hmm. up if you want. And just spread it out in the tray. You don't need to oil the tray because there's oil already in the muesli mix.
Right.
And you just put that in the oven at about 150 Celsius or about 300 Fahrenheit for between 15 to 30 minutes until it's golden brown.
Now tell us, is that about how thick you want? Like you said, we could double it. Would we want to spread it into 2 trays, or could we get that a little bit thicker?
You could get that a little bit thicker, but you don't want to have it too deep. You don't want to have it so most of the pieces are being exposed to the heat, or it may take a little bit longer.
Yeah.
So you
can stir it and leave it there a little bit longer. That's what I do. I make a double or triple recipe and get a little bit deeper dish. Stir it while I'm going, but you're right, it takes a little bit long. It's not going to be the 20-minute one, which this is great if you want a very quick... You forgot to make it last week and you need it this morning. This is great.
Exactly.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Dried fruits.
Yeah.
So we don't cook the dried fruits because they'll just go hard and really, really hard. So we just throw that, once that's out of the oven and cooled, just mix in the dried fruits, and you can use, we've got dates, sultanas, cranberries, you can use apricots, or any of your favourite dried fruits. So they're really... wonderful flavours.
Oh, great. Well, I'm looking forward to this. Now, what have you got in here with the
We've just suited up with some fresh raspberries and some soy yogurt.
Ooh, yogurt.
But they'd be great with bananas or a whole lot of different fruits. So it's
an
awesome way to start the day.
Granola has got to be my favourite breakfast. This looks wonderful. Mm.
And, of course, by making your own muesli, you're going to save a lot more money as well because it's going to work out cheaper than buying the store muesli.
Absolutely, because oats are so cheap. And that's really the basis of this breakfast, isn't it? And you can get gluten-free oats.
That's right.
It can be great all round. Well, that's a great recipe. You definitely want to try this. Thanks, Jeremy.
No worries.
The Environmental Working Group is the nation's leading environmental health research and advocacy organisation. Their mission is to help us make healthier choices and enjoy a cleaner environment. Here's a video they've made to increase our awareness.
no thought was really given to the health effects, maybe even outside acute effects on workers. I mean, if something was killing someone in a factory, you might slow down the production of it. But once it was out into the environment, there were no laws, there were no regulations, there were no thresholds. And that is largely true today. I mean, one of our toughest talking points, both with reporters and with regular people, they just can't believe these chemicals aren't regulated, but they're not.
A lot of these chemicals are post-war creations, so they entered commerce in the aftermath of World War II at a time when safety testing requirements just didn't really exist. So these chemicals have been in consumer products for decades, and a lot of them are hormone-disrupting chemicals. Once they're in our bodies, they mimic estrogen or testosterone, and they trigger all of the biological processes that hormones trigger.
We have found over 200 toxic chemicals in the umbilical cord blood of babies. So you're polluted before you're born. Some of those chemicals were banned 30 years ago, and they're still showing up in newborns today. So we have this incredibly disturbing legacy of pollutants that stick around for a long time. They're toxic. They get into our blood. And on top of that, we have a flood of new chemicals and uses of those chemicals in consumer products day in and day out that we're exposed to.
It's often overwhelming when you think of 80,000 chemicals out there in commerce and how many are entering every day into our lives. Now, if you picture a tanker truck on the road filled with industrial chemicals that haven't been tested for safety, well, picture two of those, or 10. Or 100. Picture 1,000 of those. Picture 100,000 of those tanker trucks, or 500,000 of them. Enough to line all the way from California to New York and back again. That's how many industrial chemicals enter our commerce every single day, and most of them have never been tested for safety. Now, that can be overwhelming, and it should be. We need to take action. But for an individual parent, it's important to know that we only have a very small area to defend. Our home, first of all, but even narrower than that. The chemicals get into kids basically in just three ways. It's what goes into their mouth, it's what they breathe, and what goes under their skin. And if we take charge there, that's the best way that we can protect our own kids.
And protecting our kids is exactly what we're talking about today with Dr. Barra. We've been reassured for years that each chemical is in itself not harmful and below the toxic limit. But Dr. Barra, as a researcher, how comforted are you by those reassurances?
Not very. There was an act passed in 1996 called the Food Quality Protection Act, or FQPA, that looked at pesticides in food and how they were regulated. So each pesticide had a tolerable amount that could be present in food, but the regulations at that time didn't take into account the pesticides that have common mechanisms of action. So something that inhibits one of your nerve terminals and another pesticide that inhibited the same nerve terminal weren't looked at as an additive exposure. They were looked singly, whereas together they may be above that toxic level.
Because as doctors, we would never use the same class of drug at the same time.
Yes, correct.
So this is the same thinking, isn't it?
Yes,
it is.
And
yet we didn't apply that to pesticides.
That's correct.
So has that changed?
Yes, because of FQPA, they now have to look at the cumulative exposure as well as the aggregate exposure to classes of pesticides. In addition, they have added safety factors for the fact that we know that children and fetuses may be more susceptible to these classes of chemicals, and therefore to add an additional tenfold safety to their levels.
Ah, so that is built in now.
Yes.
That's a little bit more reassuring. Now, the fact that the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and the American Society for Reproductive Medicine have come out with these statements suggests that maybe more can be done, especially for babies and children. Now, is the current U.S. chemical policy robust enough to protect children and babies?
I don't think so. So there's 85,000 chemicals that are out there, and there's very little data on how they can affect fetuses and babies.
So more needs to be done, or there needs to be more withholding of chemicals until the work is done?
I would agree with both of those. More needs to be done, and I think we need to use caution when using these chemicals. We know they wind up in our bodies. We should know what they do to our developing babies and children.
Mm. However, now the horse has bolted somewhat, hasn't it, on the 85,000. But what you're saying is for new chemicals?
Well, I think for new chemicals, the regulation should be stronger. But in addition, for the chemicals that are out there, they need to be scrutinized more carefully for their effects on developing human beings.
Mm. Wow. Now, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology statement says chemicals contribute to stillbirths, miscarriages, congenital abnormalities, childhood cancers, and impaired brain development in children. Now, are there particular chemicals that we can focus on here? You know, pull that 85,000 down to something meaningful.
In terms of what people can do in their own homes?
Or ones that can cause those things. Things that we can avoid, try to avoid, that may cause, for example, stillbirths, miscarriages, congenital abnormalities?
Yes. The first thing is to avoid tobacco smoke. So if you smoke, you are exposing yourself to chemicals. And if you're around people who smoke or in a smoky environment, there are lots of chemicals in tobacco smoke. So
like
that would 4, be a good 000. Thing to avoid.
Right. Now, you've done some work on solvents, haven't you?
I have. So solvents, including ethanol, which is the alcohol that's in alcoholic beverages, can cause birth defects and stillbirths and preterm delivery. Toluene is another solvent that people can use to get high on if they misuse it. It's easy to get a hold of, which is why it's misused. Mm. But it's in 95% of all household products. So your cleaning products have these solvents in it. So we might look for green cleaning chemicals, which avoid these solvents use. If you're going to paint a room, that's a solvent exposure. Make sure it's well ventilated. If you're pregnant and you want the nursery to be painted, you may ask your husband to do it rather than be in that room yourself.
Right. So all of those solvents, just be aware. What do they actually do? They affect the brain.
They affect the brain. So fetal solvent syndrome was described soon after fetal alcohol syndrome. So fetal alcohol syndrome is the result of a woman's heavy drinking or alcoholism during the pregnancy. And those babies have a very typical facial dysmorphia, or they have funny-looking faces in a way that we can say, yes, this baby looks like this baby, looks like this baby, when they've been delivered to an alcoholic woman.
It's time to do our exercise right after the break. But first, let's look at pollution from a different perspective. How can you avoid exposure to the 80,000 industrial chemicals in our environment? For the majority, the harmful effects are not even known. However, there is one pollutant whose effect is well known, and that's sin. It polluted this planet 6,000 years ago, and the outcome is death. However, there's hope. There is an antidote. You see, when Jesus came to earth as a baby, he made himself incredibly vulnerable. He was the Son of God, yet he took human form and came to live in this pollution. On a planet quarantined off from the rest of the universe, the rules of engagement were that if he could avoid contamination, he would become the antidote. No one else could do it. It took him every ounce of strength, but he succeeded. I want to invite you to apply the antidote today. Believe in him, accept his victory in exchange for your defilement. Then, no longer condemned, you can walk free. Sins forgiven, and you can begin to walk in victory. One day, having been cleansed by fire, Earth will have a complete makeover, and everyone who took the antidote will live here for eternity, pure and clean, no pollution of any kind.
As for me, I call to God and the Lord saves me. Evening, morning, and noon I cry out in distress, and he hears my voice.
Welcome back. Now it's time to get active. And Sean, what have you got for us?
All right, so you know what we do normally. We start with a warm-up, okay? We're gonna start with the basic alternating toe touch, okay? It's a great exercise just to stretch out the lower back and kind of just get the body warmed up. So put your hands up.
All right,
take
join
a nice
us.
Deep breath. Put the right hand up. The right hand is going to the left foot and the left hand is going to the right foot. In three, we're gonna do six. Two and one, go. One, all the way up. Two, make sure you're breathing. Three, all the way up. Four, we got two more, five, last one, and six. But you at home, you're gonna do this for about 30 seconds, okay?
All right.
Gives you enough time to get the blood pumping a little bit.
Yeah, okay? And get a good stretch.
There you go. So today's exercise, the normal, when you're doing legs, everybody's used to doing lunges forward.
Right.
What we're gonna do today is a 45 degree lunge. So instead of going forward this way, we're gonna challenge the muscles to go at a 45 degree angle, okay? So what I want you to do at home, all right, is to take a step out that way and come back to that central spot and then switch sides, okay? You have an option here. You can either stick with one side. I'm going to stick with one side. You can alternate, right? Or you can do the alternate like what you're doing,
okay?
This allows the body to work in a different angle from what it's used to, recruit different muscles, and stimulate change. That's what you want, is to change the angle up. Now, my legs are getting nice and tired.
Yes.
Okay, you can do that for about 30 seconds to a minute, okay? The good thing about it, it's a total body exercise because you now have to keep your body erect, keep the core tight, and go from side to side.
Right.
Cool.
Yep.
So that's a 45-degree lunge, all right?
Okay.
What we're going to do is the next one, have a seat, and we're going to do a sit-up, but we're going to switch it up. A normal sit-up, you come up. And you breathe. What we're gonna do is put your hands like this and go to the side.
All right.
Opposite side.
And if you can't do a full sit up, then just do a scrunch, but again to the side.
But remember, if you're gonna do that crunch, still keep the distance between your chin and your throat and your clavicle open.
Okay. Right. Pretend you've got an orange under your chin.
There you go. Don't eat the orange yet, though.
All right, three, don't eat it.
Two and one, go. One, two, three, four, five, last one, and six. Again, recruiting muscles in a different manner versus your normal standard sit-up.
Yeah, because you've got abdominal muscles going in different directions, so you're going to work those obliques.
There you go. So to couple that, we're going to go on all fours, okay? And we're going to go right here. And what I'm going to do is put my right foot underneath my left. Well, kind of like this. It's kind of hard to explain.
That way.
Yep. Yeah. If you don't have the flexibility, try it. You can put your legs here, okay? Mm-hmm. But what I want you to do at home is bring your hip all the way down and back up. Working that oblique all the way down. I'm going to stick on this side. You can alternate if you want.
Okay.
Working that oblique. The more you bring your hips down, the more you bring it up, the more you can get a contraction of that oblique. And that oblique are these muscles right here on the side.
They give you that nice
there you go.
Trim waist.
There you go. So aim for about 10 of these on each side. And then you have a nice total body workout from your lunges, your crunches, and working your legs and your obliques.
Wow.
There you go.
So we want to do those for 20 each side?
Yeah, I would say 10 to 20. I mean, it's going to challenge you regardless. You see, we're out of breath already.
Yes.
And we've only done a couple reps.
Yeah. Okay?
So at home, try it. Have fun. And
fun. That's important.
Relax.
Okay.
There you go. So let's cool down real quick.
All right.
Bring the hand all the way down. Stretching out your hamstring. Stretching out your arms. Come up nice and slow. And relax.
All right. Thanks, Sean. That's great.
Our cells love antioxidants. Antioxidants protect our cells against damage. An excellent source of antioxidants are fruits and vegetables. Fruits and veggies are high in vitamins A, C, and E, all great antioxidants. A 2011 Korean study found that vegetarians consumed approximately 2 times more antioxidant vitamins than their meat-eating counterparts. An antioxidant-rich vegetarian diet is another ageless advantage.
Okay.
Okay, now it's time for your questions. Rachel called. I am pregnant with twins at 36 weeks. Congratulations, Rachel. Which birth control is safer for me to take? I'm afraid of them all. Is there any natural birth control that's best? Well, breastfeeding is going to give you some protection, but it won't stop pregnancy. So there are various methods. One is the barrier methods, things like diaphragms and condoms. They're not as sure as a hormonal method. And so usually I'd say work out when you're most fertile. Use both at that time. And otherwise, you could probably get away with one or the other. You could take turns. There is also the rhythm method, where you time the time in your cycle when you ovulate, which is about 14 days before your next period. Or you can do it by temperature, where first thing in the morning, before you get out of bed or do anything, you slip the thermometer in and you take your basal body temperature. What you find is the day that you ovulate, your temperature goes up by about 0.4 of a degree. So by then you're already fertile. So you want to avoid 4 days before and 6 days after. That's going to be your safe time. Val emailed with several questions. She wrote, should I vaccinate my kids? What does a breastfeeding mom need in her diet? And how can I help my baby avoid colic and gas? Those are great questions, Val. Let me start with the vaccination question. This is not an easy question, and there's no doubt in my mind that vaccinations do save lives. The decision as to which vaccinations are best for your child depends on where in the world that you live, the risks to which your child might be exposed, and at what age they may be exposed, whether the vaccinations contain mercury as a preservative, and whether you're breastfeeding and sharing your immunity with your child, and for how long you intend to do that. So factor all those in and make the best choice that you can. Now, you also asked about what a breastfeeding mom needs in her diet. And that depends on whether you are vegetarian or not. But essentially, you need 30% more calories when you're breastfeeding than when you are not pregnant. Remember, a good, healthy, all-around diet with lots of variety, and include the omega-3 fats is very important, and some extra vitamin B12 if you're vegetarian or vegan, because those can easily be forgotten. Now, colic and gas, you need to just experiment. Foods in your diet are going to affect your nursing babies. So brassicas can be a problem, like cabbage, kale, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cauliflower. Those all can be one of the main culprits. But read around and see what other people have had problems with. Hope that helps. Send me more of your questions. The number's 855-400-HEALTHY. That's 855-400-4325. Or text your question to me, 301-960-5144. And please don't forget to friend us on Facebook. Go Healthy for Good Facebook page is another great way to post me your questions. Now it's time to head over to the supermarket.
The blackberry grows wild and can be a nasty weed with all those thorns, but it produces such sweet, delicious berries. We're not the only ones that like eating blackberries. So do the birds, the badgers, and even the red fox. And deer enjoy grazing on their leaves. You can see from the dark, rich colour of the berries, there are lots of polyphenols like anthocyanins, quercetin, salicylic acid and ellagic acid. They contain a good amount of soluble fibre. And with all the antioxidants, they are good for the heart and also for the brain. In fact, they are the top antioxidant food in the United States. Their seeds are even nutritious, containing omega-3 and omega-6 fats, as well as some protein and carotenoids. A whole cup only contains 60 calories. Don't cook them, just eat them raw. Bon appetit.
We're talking today with Dr. Barrett, Chief of Neonatology, about toxins and babies. Now, Dads, it's time for you to listen up. And we're continuing the conversation about the fetal solvent syndrome. Tell us about that.
So back when fetal alcohol syndrome was first identified, soon people began to recognize that the babies that were born to women who abused solvents during pregnancy had those same facial characteristics. But what's important in both fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal solvent syndrome is that the brain seems to be the most sensitive target for those chemicals. So there are a lot of mental retardation issues with children who have those diagnoses, as well as behavioral problems, learning deficits, seizure disorders. So a lot of combination of effects on the brain that result in different type of neurological problems.
So solvents are important, but you know, as you mentioned first, the alcohol, many women will have, they believe that a little alcohol is not a problem during pregnancy, but there's no safe lower limit, is there?
There's no safe limit that we know of at any time during pregnancy, and there's no benefit to drinking alcohol during pregnancy. So we recommend, if I as a neonatologist recommends, and I believe ACOG, you know, agrees with this, that we should encourage women not to drink at all during pregnancy. Now, you can still be exposed to that alcohol without drinking alcohol.
Is that right?
Yes, because many products you can buy over the counter contain alcohol. Cough syrup contains alcohol, or some cough syrups contain alcohol. Some mouthwashes contain alcohol. The vanilla extract that you put in cakes and everything contains alcohol.
But with the mouthwash, you're spitting it out. Are you suggesting that it will be absorbed through the mucosa of the mouth?
Yes. So alcohol can very easily cross any cell membranes, which is why it's so easy to cross from the woman's bloodstream into the fetal bloodstream. It can go right across the placenta.
Something to remember. Now, a recent study of organic pollutants has also shown the impact of exposure to the mother was quite different to the impact of exposure to the father. And this supports other scientific evidence that the health and lifestyle of dads impacts their children. Now, what evidence do you see in the scientific literature that supports this?
Well, epigenetics is a new area of science that says that even though your DNA may be the same, that there are markers on the DNA that allow different genes to be expressed. So dads can be exposed to things in the environment that changes these marks on their sperm. And when one of the sperm fertilizes the egg and becomes a fetus, the fetus experiences those changes in the DNA marks. One example of an exposure that we know dads have prior to conception of the pregnancy, although we don't know if it's through epigenetics now or not, is the consumption of hot dogs.
Hot dogs.
Hot dogs. So hot dogs contain a carcinogen, a nitrosamine, which is an identified carcinogen. And in a study done in California, they took cases of children who had childhood leukemia and controlled children, and then asked the parents how many hot dogs and other cured meats they had had.
All the processed meats.
Yes, all the processed meats. But it turned out that it was only the hot dogs that had a significant association with the kids who had leukemia and not with the kids who didn't have the leukemia. It turns out for the highest consumption of hot dogs amongst the dads, their children had a tenfold increased risk for developing leukemia. If the children themselves ate the hot dogs, they also increased their risk by 10%. And if both the dads ate a lot of hot dogs and the children ate a lot of hot dogs, they had a 20-fold increased risk of having leukemia.
And the mother's hot dog consumption?
No effect.
Wow. So the chemicals in the meats can have that big a difference,
yes.
That big an impact. Yes. So dads, you really need to think about how you're living life. Don't put it all on the mums. Now, Dr. Barker was a British researcher who found that nutrition of the mother during pregnancy could set a baby up for chronic disease throughout life. Now, begin to tell us, at least before we go to break, that the early work that Dr. Barker did.
Well, he recognized that in children or in adults that had been born during the Dutch hunger winter that occurred during World War II, when Holland was under siege by the Nazis and people were starving to death in Holland during this time, that severe deprivation of calories changed the way the fetuses in utero who had experienced that and how they conserved their calories as they grew up.
So we're going to finish this story in just a moment. Stay with us. After the break, we'll continue this discussion with Dr. Barra.
I know I'm looking for something. But what? Peace? Purpose? Meaning? I'm still not sure. But I know it's going to take faith.
Welcome back. If you have a health question, then call 855-400-HEALTHY, post it on Facebook, or text it to 301-960-5144. Endocrine disruptors are industrial chemicals that interfere with our hormones, either thyroid hormones or sex hormones, and they're leaching into our environment, affecting the creatures that inhabit our waterways. Here's a clip from the documentary Frontline, produced by PBS.
Endocrine disruptors are very, very potent chemicals at infinitesimally small quantification. I mean, you're talking about parts per million or parts per billion. They interrupt the normal way in which the body controls everything from growth and development to thyroid function to reproductive function to estrogen levels, testosterone levels. So they're very, very important, and they are a deep concern because there are so many of them now.
There are thousands of these worrisome chemicals that have gotten into the environment. And one reason is that they're part of everything we do.
The list of things that bring these organic pollutants into our bodies is a long list. And it ranges from home care products, soaps, toothpaste, cleaning agents in the household, to things we put on our lawns, the things that we use all the time, the plastic industry, the rubber industry, lubricants, fuels, the highways.
When you see scientists like Vicky Blazer cutting open fish, finding intersex in the male fish, seeing high levels of fish kills, seeing immune systems disrupted, seeing other damage to the fish, is that a warning to you potentially about human health?
Oh, absolutely. The warning not just from the smallmouth bass in the Potomac, but from amphibians all across the country. You have frogs with six legs, hermaphroditic frogs, male frogs with ovaries, female frogs with male genitalia. These are the canaries, the modern canary in the mine, that we haven't been paying enough attention to.
So, ready to pay attention? Let's see what history tells us, and then consider if history might repeat itself in a more widespread way. Now, you were just telling us about Dr. Parker's work and how babies that were in utero during the Dutch famine, their mothers experienced severe nutritional deprivation. What happened to them as they grew up? What was their health like?
As children, they were normal. I don't think they raised anybody's, you know, concerns about them. But as adults, they started having much more chronic disease. They were more at risk for coronary artery disease and hypertension. Kidney disease was also part of one of the outcomes that people think is being affected by the fetal environment.
And do we still, now that was an isolated event during the war, but what are we seeing now? Tell us about how that's now being applied to today's babies.
Well, we have an obesity epidemic now, and so people are postulating that the fetuses who are now exposed to too many calories, it's also changing their phenotype in the way that they're preparing themselves for life outside the womb. So it appears that the womb environment really is set up to prepare the baby for what they can expect when they're born in terms of saving calories or losing calories. So now the babies that are experiencing extra calories are winding up with some of those same chronic diseases that you get with extreme calorie deprivation.
And then I also believe that growth restriction in utero is a little bit like the Dutch famine babies, that babies born too small, for example, smoking moms or when the placenta hasn't worked as well as we would expect it to, that those babies also are set up for cardiovascular disease and hypertension and obesity and all of those things.
That's correct. And actually there's a group over at Johns Hopkins that's studying that right now, looking at those epigenetic marks in the placenta, which is part of the fetus, and in cord blood to try to identify those genes that are affected by that abnormal in uterine environment.
As a neonatologist, what do you advise mums who've had a growth-restricted baby to try and feed them well to get some catch-up in that first year to try and protect them?
Yes, babies who are born too small for gestational age do experience catch-up growth if given enough calories.
There are many chemicals that are endocrine disruptors, but a very topical one is bisphenol A, or BPA, which is a synthetic estrogen. Exposure in utero and shortly after birth is linked to future health problems, including breast cancer, prostate cancer, metabolic changes, decreased fertility, early puberty, neurological problems, and immunological changes. To reduce BPA exposure amongst infants, it's now been banned from baby bottles for about 1 year. Now, since BPA is similar to DES, which was an estrogen that we used to use way back, tell us about the DES story.
Well, women were given DES, I believe that they were threatening to have abortions. And it certainly saved those babies. But about 20 years after the start of the use of DES, the female offspring, or the women who were the girl babies in utero, began to have adenocarcinoma of the vagina or of the cervix. And upon closer examination, they were found to have what we call genital urinary tract malformations. So their cervix was malformed, which led to its susceptibility to having cancer. They were also found to have uteruses that, rather than having one large compartment, would have two horns on it as a result of the exposure.
Mm. What about the boy babies?
The boy babies have a higher incidence of breast cancer also in that first generation. Now this is long enough that we're looking at the second generation. So those babies that were exposed as ova and sperm, and the babies that were in utero when their mothers took DES. Does that make sense?
Yes. So these are the grandchildren of those original women.
Correct. And they would have still had direct exposure from DES because
Her girl baby had her ovaries and her boy baby had the testes already.
Yes. And so in those offspring, we're seeing more of the GU malformations also in the boys. They seem to have more abnormal placement of the urethra on the tip of the penis, and also more breast cancer in boys, which is a relatively rare occurrence.
Right.
The girls are still at risk for higher rates of breast cancer.
So now we'll be waiting to see if the not directly affected offspring, next generation, have an effect from that.
Yes. So people are thinking that DES, because it acts as a hormone that changes DNA expression, and it acts through epigenetic changes, that these changes in those markers on the DNA that we were talking about can be inherited. So right now we don't know because there's still direct exposure, but with the subsequent generation, if we still see the abnormality, it means that the changes in the epigenetics of the DNA is heritable.
Right, and so those switches were thrown on from the previous generation.
Yes.
Now, a heavy metal that springs to mind and which we're all aware of is mercury. And I think of what happened when there was that massive industrial accident in a Minamata, Japan in 1956. Now, what effects do mercury have? And how worried do we need to be nowadays?
Well, mercury can exist in several different forms. And the company that released the mercury to Minamata Bay, they actually released inorganic mercury. But because it went into the sediment of the bay, it was converted into an organic form of mercury by the algae or goop that's on the bottom of the bay.
Uh-huh.
And therefore, the little fish ate it, and then the bigger fish came along and ate the little fish, and then the big fish came along. And Minamata Bay was the home of a fisherman village.
And so people came along and ate the big fish.
People came along and ate the big fish, and so did the cats. So the people got the best part of the fish, and the cats got the leftovers. And they began to realize that they were seeing more neurodegenerative diseases in their elderly population. And then they started seeing that the babies were getting a lot of severe cerebral palsy, a different form of cerebral palsy than we usually think about. And then the cats began to have this really stiff gait and then they'd have seizures and fall over dead. And it was actually a veterinarian that connected the link that the cats had methylmercury poisoning. And then they went back and they looked at the kids and the elderly, and they had higher levels of mercury that was traced to the mercury contamination of the fish. So
the elderly and the babies were the most affected.
Actually, it was the fetuses. So if a woman was pregnant, she was spared any of the symptoms of the methylmercury poisoning, because the mercury, methylmercury, actually goes to the fetus. It's preferentially
transferred across the placenta
into the fetus and to the fetal brain.
So it's important not to have sylvan fillings during pregnancy?
I think it's yes, and you know, there's still a debate over that, but I would encourage members of my family not to get the mercury fillings. But fish is still contaminated. So there are four fish that FDA says that pregnant women should not eat, and they are the top predators. They're the swordfish. I think it's swordfish, tilefish, monkfish, and maybe mackerel? No, it's not tuna.
Not tuna.
Canned tuna, actually, if you get the albacore tuna, is relatively low in mercury. So Environmental Working Group has on their website, you know, what fish is good to eat. And fish is good to eat because it contains a lot of the nutrients that fetuses need. Mm. But how to have it in moderation, so you're not eating too much mercury. PCB, another one of those persistent organic pollutants, also builds up in the fat of fish. So to skin the fish, if you cook it on a grill, let the fat run off of the fish, will lower the PCB.
Mm. Or you can avoid it by having omega-3s from plant sources also, and get maybe omega-3s that way. And Environmental Working Group's website, by the way, is ewg.org. Now, what are some of the practical things that parents, potential parents, can do to protect themselves and their babies?
Well, be aware of the fishing advisories and how much fish consumption that you're eating.
And you mentioned smoking. Avoid smoking.
So avoid smoking. Be in a well-ventilated place if you have to work with solvents, or be aware of what the solvents are around you. Look into green cleaning products. And know what you're exposed to at work. A lot of workplaces have exposures to people who work there. And again, that's not regulated for the fetus that's in the workplace. It's regulated for mostly for men who are in the workplace. So just be aware of what you're being exposed to there.
Mm, good point. And then we also mentioned the alcohol.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. Our time is all gone, but it's been wonderful to have you.
Thank you very much.
You've heard it from our expert today. Avoid smoking and alcohol. There is no safe limit to alcohol in pregnancy. So simply abstain before you even get pregnant. And that goes for you too, men. It's not just hot dogs that can harm your baby, it's all processed meats. So mums and dads-to-be, take care. Wash pesticides and herbicides off your food. Buy organic when you can. Limit your exposure to solvents. Avoid BPA and canned food and plastic bottles. Watch our shows on epigenetics to find out how to switch your genes to a favourable setting for the sake of your unborn child. You'll both benefit. Thanks for joining us on Go Healthy for Good. I'll see you next time.